This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Why should you listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand?
We're not boring. A lot of news is boring.
And tedious.
And depressing.
And makes you angry. You don't want to live your life like that.
Hey, I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty.
We're Armstrong and Getty.
We try to bring you the truth.
And help you figure out this crazy modern world.
How about something about a comedic tone?
We have a winner.
Yes. Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on the iHeartRadio app,
Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, so let's have what may be a little bit of a sober talk, but I think it's an important talk about politics, nations in general. Standard of living is a real thing that you're well aware of, obviously, but standard of living is a real thing. What does that mean, standard of living? Well, how much food can you afford? Can you feed yourself? Can you house yourself? Can you clothe yourself? These are obviously the basics that matter to people, but it's more than that. Human beings, we're not just set economic pieces. We have thoughts, feelings, desires. We want to do fun things too. And you know what? There's nothing wrong with that. You want to be able to throw your family in the car and drive down to the movies if Hollywood actually puts out something that's not weird and gay. Of course you do. It's perfectly natural. The problem we have right now is we remember better days. We remember the year 2019 because it's not ancient history. We remember the days when you could afford to go to Red Lobster on a Friday night and maybe a movie afterwards when that wasn't a $300 affair. And the truth is that most people out there, the people we share a society with, they're not political animals like we are. They don't know all the things we know about inflation and money printing and taxes and regulations. Most people don't know that. Most people know, oh my goodness, I just tried to buy a plane ticket to go see my mom. I go every year for Christmas, and that's three times what we were paying before. Right now, the American people are watching their standard of living go down because they can't afford anything. Certainly not what they used to be able to afford. President Trump gave a national address. Here's a little bit of it.
I inherited a mess, and I'm fixing it. When I took office, inflation was the worst in 48 years, and some would say in the history of our country, which caused prices to be higher than ever before, making life unaffordable for millions and millions of Americans. This happened during a Democrat administration, and it's when we first began hearing the word affordability.
Okay. It is true that Democrats, because they're communists who don't care about you, made everything worse. They certainly made inflation so much worse. But if we're going to be honest here, if we're going to be adults, that's not the moment inflation got out of control. The moment inflation got completely out of control was this moment.
We're announcing new guidelines for every American to follow over the next 15 days as we combat the virus. Each and every one of us has a critical role to play in stopping the spread and transmission of the virus. We did this today. This was done by a lot of very talented people, some of whom are standing with me.
I hate to beat a dead horse, but if we're going to be honest, let's be honest. And we're going to have this talk so we don't ever make this mistake again. You don't ever force your economy to stop. There may be things that force parts of your economy to stop. There's no question about it. If there is a huge plague, parts of your economy are going to stop. If there's a huge war, there are things that are going to cause parts of your economy to stop. But that's drastically different than governments, federal, state, and local, pointing a finger at their economy and saying, stop. Nobody go to work. Close your doors. Lock yourself in your home. You can go get liquor, but stay at home. Watch Netflix. Stop. But what about money? Don't worry. We're just going to print $7 trillion, $8 trillion. Oh, you're worried about your finances? We'll pass a $1 trillion spending bill and send you a check. That was the moment life became unaffordable for so many people. Why are we sitting here right now and we're looking at record credit card debt? Record credit card debt across the country. Because people are trying, understandably trying, maybe this is you, to maintain some semblance of the standard of living they had like yesterday. But the truth is, the hard truth is, that's not coming back. And they're not even trying to bring it back. Wrap your mind around this. The Federal Reserve, it's kind of their, this inflation, deflation thing is kind of their baby, right? The Federal Reserve has openly stated that their goal for inflation is 2%. Wait a minute, what? That's not zero. That's not negative one. They're not even attempting to bring prices back down. They're never coming back down. And this is going to plague politicians and their popularity for years to come, because people remember when it didn't cost $125 to go to the movies with a popcorn and a Coke for the kids. People remember. I'm sure you remember. I remember. I'm angry about it. I am angry that you've watched your standard of living go down. I'm angry that politicians did that to us. Let's talk a bit about the reasons. We're going to talk to Jeffrey Tucker, Tiana Lodesher. We have a packed show tonight. We'll be back. I like companies that hire Americans. It's become almost an obsession of mine. I'll get on the website when I'm thinking about buying something, and I want to see, do you hire Americans? You know, all these call centers. You know why they put them overseas, right? It's cheaper. You don't care about Americans or American jobs. You go hire click at some dump where they don't even have toilets, and you pay them nothing, and that's the reason you're on the phone. What? I don't. And he can't understand you. It's a nightmare. At PureTalk, the American cell phone company, they hire Americans who speak English, and they're actually pleasant. Switch from Verizon, switch from AT&T, switch from T-Mobile, switch to the company that cares enough about this country to hire Americans. They'll charge you less. They're on the same towers. Be pro-American, all right? PureTalk.com/JesseTV. Far-reaching consequences of what we're doing to try to stop the spread of this virus. Maybe they're necessary, maybe they're not, but we are talking about massive, massive economic losses coming, and that's just the truth. We are going to be feeling this for not just, you know, the coming months, for years. No, we're not going to be in lockdown for years, but the economic impact of this is going to be, it's going to be something.
I had so much hair back then. Also, there weren't enough of us screaming that, but one of the people who most definitely was Jeffrey Tucker, of course, founder of Brownstone Institute, author of the new wonderful book, Spirits of America. Everybody knows Jeffrey. Jeffrey, I mean, obviously, it's evident all around us still, the impacts of that lockdown. It's awful. It hasn't gone away. No one wants to own up to the fact that the reason everything's 25% more expensive is because we shut down the country for a chest cold. No one wants to just address that fact.
Yeah, and inflation's still ongoing. The president said inflation is gone or it's over or something like that. But it's not true. Inflation just once again clocked in at 2.7, which is still above even the historical average. And it still means prices are going up. Prices are not going back to where they were. You say 25%, maybe it's 30% for some goods. It's 100%. You know, the trauma is hitting us now in 2025 because people weren't out shopping for all the things they've been buying this year, and they get sticker shock every time they leave their house and enter into any kind of retail outlet and look at the price of anything. It's just shocking, whether it's clothing or household appliances or cars or food or whatever. And people are mad about it, and it does no good just pretend like this is not going on or it's the problem is going away. I'm worried, actually, that we're on an upswing. Yes, it was down from last month's figure of 3%, but we look at it since February, we've seen an upward march pretty unrelentingly. And now with the urge for the Fed to lower rates even more, you get another push of upward momentum. And then you've got the trade issues, which mean fewer dollars leaving this country to buy goods and services from abroad and more dollars staying at home. That increases the velocity of money, which drives up inflation further. So, you know, are we headed to a second wave? I sure hope not, but there's a lot of things baked into this that look like we might be. And I, as I've been screaming now for 5 years, it's all a consequence of the COVID response. Somebody had to print the money to make it look as if you can shut down an economy and still survive. And that's what they did. They printed, you know, whatever it is, you know, $5, 6, 7, 8 trillion. Congress spent about the same amount of money. We pretended to be prosperous for a year until 2 years later, that prosperity is wiped out by a devalued dollar. It's the stupidest, you know, the most ridiculous monetary policy in the history of humanity. And we did it right here. And even today, nobody talks about it.
Jeffrey, it's kind of a long question. I don't generally like doing this, but here's what I see a potential issue being for not just Trump, for every future president. COVID wasn't that long ago. Therefore, people remember when they were paying 25% less, 100% less. It's still fresh in their minds. And now, doesn't matter who you are, Republican, Democrat, what you pass, people are going to remember for a while that prices used to be this, and you said you were going to get them back to this, but they're not going back to this. So every president, every political party is going to have to face the anger of the public who wants prices to go back down, but they won't.
They will not go back down. And part of the reason for that is that all the ruling class benefits from inflation. There's also an irrational fear of lower prices, if you can believe it. Like, even Trump said this. He said the deflation is even worse than inflation. Oh, really? Well, we had 30 years or 25 years of deflation in the Gilded Age period, and it was gentle deflation, and it was the most prosperous, biggest increase in American prosperity or of any country in the history of the planet, and it was a deflationary regime, meaning that the prices were gradually declining. There's nothing wrong with declining prices, but the ruling class has an irrational fear of it. So I don't know. I'm worried that we are headed to the second wave. It's a great concern. I don't know how America would survive such a thing. I mean, even now, what the Democrats are calling the affordability crisis is very much real, and all of it traces to the COVID response. Jesse, the other thing I wanted to mention to you in this respect is the jobs report that came out a couple of days ago. There was, and I've not seen any mention of this. I have an article coming out about it today in the Epoch Times, but still, even now, the labor participation rate and the worker population ratios are still much lower than they were in 2019. There was a little bit of a recovery, but they're sinking now even more. So you can see the COVID period just broke the labor markets entirely, broke the spirit of so many workers who just never went back to work. And we're at a significantly lower level of participation, even in job markets, than we were 6 years ago. And there doesn't seem to be any fix for it. And this affects, it's revelatory of the American work ethic, which was destroyed. The difficulty that businesses have in rehiring employees because it's so expensive to provide all the benefits that everybody's demanding, to provide a high salary, and then the ridiculously priced healthcare. So we're not even going to go back to labor participation level of 2019 anytime soon, if ever. That's how bad it is.
Jeffrey, can you expand? We're actually going to come back to that. Can you expand a little bit on why the elites like inflation, because that can get confusing to people who don't have private jets and $1 billion. What did they get out of inflation?
Well, especially in our time, elites are very much a live-off leverage. It's a very strange thing. Ever since zero interest rate policies began, more or less quasi in 2000, so 25 years ago, every high-end business and individual is leveraged up to the hilt. So they're borrowing money on the cheap, and spending it and living high. Right? I mean, that's just sort of the way it works. Well, inflation reduces the value of the dollars and therefore reduces the burden of the debts that they owe. So you can inflate away a debt gradually. And, you know, if you're looking at hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars, that's a lot of money. So inflation is actually beneficial, financially beneficial for any indebted class of people. And that's one way. And the biggest debtor of all is, guess what, the U.S. government. And who's behind the inflation? The U.S. government. So it's a way of paying off the debt without having to tax people, essentially, is what it is. That's why it's such a scam and why it's been practiced for thousands of years.
And the opposite of that, that's why I'm assuming they don't want deflation, why they fear deflation. Because I've never had somebody explain this to me properly, why I shouldn't want prices to go down. I would like my dollar to go further. Why is that bad?
Wouldn't that be great if you could save money and actually make money by saving it even without interest? I mean, so that if you socked away money in your mattress, whatever, and dug it out 10 years later, it would be more valuable. I mean, that's just inconceivable. So that would promote frugality, right? And savings and long-term thinking and investment. In other words, all the values that built this country, you know, that would be the best thing ever for the American work ethic and frugality. Wouldn't that be something if you knew for sure that if you spent your money today, you were basically losing the money you would otherwise sort of earn by holding it for 5 years because it would be more valuable in 5 years than it is today? That's an ideal world. I mean, that's how you reinforce the bourgeois ethic. I mean, deflation is really, really good for the human spirit and resets everything on the right kilter. So people start saving, start being frugal, start thinking about the future for the first time. Inflation reverses all that. It rewards present thinking, rewards indebtedness, punishes frugality, and rewards spendthriftness and short-term thinking. So there's a value issue here. Now, a lot of the fear of deflation traces to, you guessed it, the Great Depression, right? So an experience of almost 100 years ago, people are still spooked. Well, a lot of economists during the Great Depression just basically made a mistake. They thought the problem was falling prices, whereas in fact, the falling prices were probably, well, they were in fact the solution to a more fundamental dislocation in capital allocations that happened throughout the structure of production. So they misdiagnosed the problem. They said, oh, look, these prices are falling. This is terrible. We have to get them back up again. This was not a solution to the Great Depression. And so we've misunderstood this for the better part of 90 years, and it still imposed this sort of deflation phobia that you see among almost all economists and the government itself. So they always figure you're better off with inflation than deflation. I can tell you from the average point of view of the regular consumer, you're way better off with deflation than inflation.
Jeffrey, you mentioned obviously labor participation and why it's down. And I guess this is one of those things that confuses me. Granted, I understand I'm from a different generation where I just always wanted a job. Everyone got a job. You say COVID broke people in this way, that they just decided, okay, I lost my job, they took away my job, and now I'm not going back. But how do people live when they don't have a job? I'm just so confused as to how it's possible.
Yeah. Well, I think the conventional answer here is live off parents and live off welfare, right? I mean, I think that's basically the sum of it. People can't be bothered. You know, what happened over the course of a year or more is that the U.S. government, combined with media and big tech and all the other institutions that were involved, encouraged a whole generation to stay home and stream movies and do nothing while money poured into their bank accounts that even told people, you don't have to pay your rent. If anybody tries to kick you out of your apartment, they're doing something bad. So it was a weird year-long experiment in telling people, there's no relationship between the work you do and the money you make. It's all a fake. If the government wants you to have money, you will make even more money, especially for the essential workers, right? They pretended to work at home, and then they're still getting stimulus payments from the government. They're richer than ever while doing absolutely nothing. So an experience like that, you just don't forget. I think that's what broke the American work ethic. Not at all places. Like, I was just in Texas. Everything seems to be more or less functioning, as far as I could tell, at least compared to New England, where you hire somebody for a job and you're lucky if they show up at all. I mean, I'm serious. That's how bad it is. I have business people that I know who keep trying to hire employees. I was talking to somebody the other day. He said, well, my new employee only shows up half the time, but hey, that's better than the last two employees I hired who never showed up at all. So that's kind of where we are. I don't know. Yeah, no, it's really, really bad. Fake job applications. A lot of times, and this is still going on, people apply for jobs and go all the way through the process so they can prove to the unemployment insurance agency that they're indeed on the job market and just can't seem to find anything, you know. This is still going on. We've become a country of scammers and racketeers. And again, I think there's corruption in place before, but the COVID response just rewarded the worst aspects of human nature and embedded that deeply in the culture. And everybody's still broken as a result. I want to mention one other piece of data that came out from the jobs report the other day about which nobody's talking. Disability, self-reported, a household survey of disability is soaring. This is a stable measure that's been used for, I don't know, like 20 years. And it's absolutely going through the roof. We saw the largest monthly increase in the number of disabled people. We're looking at, I think, 36 million six is what it comes down to. And that's about 6 million more than existed in 2019. Now, are these real disabilities? I'm tending to think they might be. And so what would be the source of that? Well, there's ill health. People put on 20 pounds on average during the COVID lockdowns. There's substance abuse. People turn to the bottle, to narcotics, to weed. But very crucially, disability went down in the 6 months before the release of the shot. And then in February 2021, it started soaring, and it's not stopped going up. So your guess is as good as mine, but everything we know about the shots, it doesn't look good from a safety profile, and it turned out to be utterly inefficacious, not to mention wholly unnecessary. So you've got a lot of disability. At least some portion of that, if not the dominant share of those disabilities, are probably traceable to the great inoculation that was going to get us out of COVID. So the story just gets worse and worse and worse the more you look into it.
Gosh, it friggin' does. Jeffrey, before we get to healthcare, I actually want to touch on something you just brought up about the difference between New England and Texas. You're starting to see this, the disparity between your quality of life in a blue state, a blue area, versus a red one. You have Californians putting up pictures paying $4, $5, $6 a gallon for gas. I filled up last night at $2.19 a gallon on my way home from work. The truth is that blue states appear like they're going to keep circling the drain quickly, and you've almost got to get to a red place to afford life.
Yeah, I have an article called It's All Smiles in Texas. That's the name of the article, and it says by Jeffrey Tucker, but I haven't written the article yet. Part of the problem is we're always reluctant to make these regional comparisons, but I don't know. I spent 3 days in Texas. I spent 3 days of being absolutely startled. Why? It's not just that the prices were lower, but the ethic is different. I was in a drugstore and buying some nasal spray or something like that, and the guy says, at the counter says, well, sir, I want to point out to you that this generic product is much cheaper for more quantity. Would you like me to put that in your bag instead? I stood there thinking, wait a minute, you just declined to sell me a more expensive product in favor of a cheaper product. That's the most amazing thing that's happened to me in years. I couldn't believe it. I thought, well, yeah, what's the catch? You know, that kind of thing. The other thing I couldn't get used to in Texas is that the drivers are still polite. And when people would talk to you, they would actually smile. I know from any Texan listening to this is going, yeah, that's the way human beings are. Not so much in Blue State New England. I mean, you know, the drivers are rude, there's no smiles, and the idea that a merchant would want to save you money on anything is utterly crazy. We have two completely different cultures rising up in red states versus blue states, and I don't know how that's sustainable. It's so weird. The idea of one nation, it seems to be gradually vanishing. And now we've got these secessionist states in New England and the coastal states that have cobbled together their own CDC vaccination schedule to secede from the CDC's now trimmed childhood vaccination schedule. They're imposing their own mandates for their own schedule. So that's how bad it's gotten. And some states in New England are considering even taking away the existing religious exemptions. So it's getting worse, not better.
Speaking of healthcare, I got an email last night. I can't stop thinking about it because my wife and I, we just had to renew our family's health insurance and we were a little sticker shocked. And I got an email from a guy, $27,000 a year he is paying for health insurance for him, his wife, two kids. That is, look, whatever the solutions are, and there have to be good solutions, someone has to come up with one, because that's a full-time job for most people just to afford health insurance. Where is this going?
It's unbelievable what's happening. Of course, this is all a consequence of Obamacare. What Obamacare tried to do was create a single-payer system through the private health insurance markets. So they put together these defined benefits packages. So all the packages, you know, have all sorts of things you don't need, but as long as you have them, you might as well use them, right? And so people have overutilized the resource because the actuaries have not been pricing the healthcare according to existing risk. So everybody's pillaging everybody else and devouring as much healthcare services as they can. The actuaries are looking at the consumption of healthcare and going, well, we've got to raise premiums, to the point at which, yeah, the family of four, $27,000, that's pretty much where we're going to be here, or where we are within the next month. Completely unsustainable. And the other thing to mention, Tessie, is this is before you actually use it, right? The deductibles on these plans can be $10,000, $20,000, even $50,000. So you think you have health insurance. That's what you pay to have the insurance, right? That's not what you pay to use the insurance. So it's actually much, much worse. So yeah, there's no way this system can last. Now, Trump had this really good idea, and he said it in his national address, that instead of giving the Obamacare subsidies, forget what happened, just go back. Obamacare, of course, blew up all health insurance premiums, so Congress decided to cover that up by subsidizing the insurance companies and keeping the premiums low. Well, that is now expiring, and people are seeing the reality on the ground, which is these astronomical increases. Trump says, well, look, why don't we give the money directly to citizens instead of to the insurance companies? Okay, this is a brilliant suggestion, but there's a hang-up on it. Once you get the cash, even if it is in a health savings account, which right now you can't even get an HSA unless you have insurance, with some exceptions, but generally that's true. So if you get that money from the government for your healthcare, you still have to go out and buy healthcare. So it actually doesn't solve the problem. It actually just creates a complication. So instead of government sending money to the health insurers, they're sending it to you, and then you send it to the health insurers. So in other words, there's got to be other structural reforms. We need catastrophic plans. We need to have a freer market. Any insurer should be allowed to get into the market or operate across state lines and offer any benefit package at any price that consumers want. I'm guessing that if you can test really healthy and that you're not going to overtax and trim it out, get rid of dental, get rid of mental, get rid of all this nonsense that you don't need, and just get the catastrophic you want, you might be able to get down to a premium that's low enough that actual human beings could afford. But that's going to require dramatic structural change. And the Republicans don't seem to be up for this. They're not seriously considering cutting the insurers off. Another thing that absolutely must happen, and I think the Republicans are getting hip to this, we've got to untie health insurance from employment. They never should have been there tied together at all. It only came about because of the exigencies of price controls during World War II, and we got stuck with it. But it needs to go away completely. Like, we need to allow the employees to leave health insurance from the employer. Employers should be allowed to drop their employees from health insurance in exchange for which they get, say, an increase in salary or wages. I think a lot of people would take it. And we need to expand the availability of health savings accounts for people who are not insured. We're taking inches towards such solutions. For example, you can now, I think, get a health insurance, health savings account if you have a direct primary care provider, right? So that's a slight step. It's not enough. We need HSAs as for every citizen, no matter what, so you can just save money to provide your health care. Maybe you can go out into a free marketplace and buy whatever kind of insurance you want at any level, and it should be priced according to your individual risk, the same as your auto insurance. Right now, it's not really insurance because that's not the way the system works. So here's the thing, Jesse. We know the solutions. The problem is that most, and this includes Republicans, politicians that are in a position to make the kind of dramatic reforms we need are in the pay of the health insurers themselves and the pharmaceutical companies that are backing this beastly hegemon that is pillaging everybody's families today.
Jeffrey, thank you for schooling us again, sir. I appreciate you very much. I'm a chip man. Everybody knows. My wife would describe me as a chip man. Watching something, hanging out. I've just got a bag of chips. I've always been this way. It's terrible. I just have to snack on chips. But I'm 44. I'm not 24. The days of being able to drink toxic waste and be fine are gone for me. Start to feel it around the midsection. You start to feel fat and bloated. Vandy Crisps. That's your new potato chip. It's fresh. Three ingredients. That's it. No more seed oil garbage. Just potatoes, salt, tallow, and they're fantastic. I would highly recommend the Smokehouse. My son loves the ones that taste like Italian dressing. They have just plain potato chips. Vandy Crisps are your way. You can eat chips guilt-free. Go to VandyCrisps.com/JesseTV. That saves you 25% off your first order. It's the Christmas season. Eat your chips. Enjoy your chips without being fat.
The Democrat inflation disaster, again, the worst in the history of our country, also robbed millions of Americans of home ownership and indeed the American dream. The yearly cost of a typical new mortgage increased by $15,000 under Democrat rule. In 11 months, we've already gotten that annual cost down by $3,000, and it's coming down a lot lower. Wait till you see, the numbers are going to be shocking, and mortgage payments will be coming down even further. Early the new year, and you will see this, in the new year, I will announce some of the most aggressive housing reform plans in American history.
Okay. Good. I hope. I hope these prices come down. Joining me now, someone who will give it to us straight, my friend Tiana Lowe Desher, columnist with the Washington Examiner. Tiana, okay, let's begin at the beginning. There's a lot of internet fodder out there about why housing is so expensive and frankly unobtainable now for so many people. And it's, I know it's a long, complicated answer, but the good news is we're not restrained by time. Why is housing so expensive now?
Okay, well, the thing is, it's really not as complicated as people would like to make it. It's just supply. At the margins, yes. You know, we did have too many illegal aliens, and there are places that spend way more money on welfare, so Section 8 does take up some of the supply. But on net, it is not a demand-side issue. It is a supply-side issue. So what happened after the Great Recession, after the housing bubble collapsed, the boomers stopped building housing for 10 years. For all the 2010s, we were building housing at half the rate than we were in the stagflation of the 70s. And that's despite a population that was much larger. Why? Because you had a bunch of boomers that treated their homes like asset bubbles. So especially in blue cities and blue areas, they made it illegal, not just, you know, for you can't come onto my property and build new housing, but you can't build new housing on your own property, right? And it's why Texas is not having the same affordability crisis that you're having in California, where, you know, homes are basically passed down like medieval fiefdoms. Now, the mortgage thing is real, and the mortgage thing is a consequence of Bidenomics. That is a consequence of Joe Biden lighting the US dollar on fire, inflation almost hitting the double digits. The Federal Reserve had to respond by increasing interest rates. And it took a long time of those interest rates staying up pretty high. And now finally the Fed's bringing them down a little bit, but it takes time because the fact is we're basically dealing with a backlog of about 7 million new units. You know, just that you have kids, the idea is that the kids one day grow up, leave the house, hopefully get married, hopefully have kids of their own. So like theoretically we should be needing more housing units. We didn't build them for 10 years. And so this is why President Trump is previewing a lot of these housing initiatives, because I know that yesterday, French Hill and House Republicans, the House Financial Services Committee, they are pushing through like the biggest housing markup in 20 years because they understand, you know, a lot of the inflation, Trump has done a pretty good job working on bringing back down to that 2% benchmark, but that's not how housing's working. Housing, it's just, you know, the median home price was about 410 when Trump took office, and it stayed 410. And that is 45% higher than it was before COVID.
410 grand. Good freaking grief. Okay, Tiana, I know you probably share this with me. I wince a little when I think about the federal government getting involved to fix anything at all, let alone the housing market. But what are some things they could do? What are they going to do? Is there anything? What's coming, and should I be afraid?
No, I mean, for the most part, this is actually pretty good action because it's using the federal bully pulpit to force local government out of the way. So Houston, Florida, these should be the national models, right? Austin and Miami and Palm Beach, these are the national models for housing, where basically, if it's your property, you get to build on it. And guess what? In Austin, you have like people who live in big rental towers, and they've been posting their notices for the year saying, oh, my rent's going down 10% next year. Don't need to move, just getting a decrease. So what a lot of these housing bills are going to do is make it so you can have more manufactured homes. So for instance, if you have a lot, you have a two-bedroom home, but you wanna buy an addition, it's way cheaper to be able to buy sort of a pre-made manufactured addition for an extra bedroom because you're having a third kid than it is to hire a contractor to have to do it manually. Secondarily, it's getting rid of these bogus environmental reviews. So again, I'm from California, and the Coastal Commission just, it's an excuse to not build anything. And so the idea with some of the federal housing legislation is to try and use all the money that we're giving to these states anyway, and say, hey, as a condition of getting it, you need to get rid of some of these environmental regulations. So look, anytime the federal government is trying to induce demand, hard no. If they're trying to spend money on increasing supply, that's also not good. But if the idea is to use, if Trump wants to use the federal government to force local nanny state to get out of the way, that is where we should be on board.
Tiana, we are now, sadly, an economy that runs on consumer spending. You know, we're not based on hard things like manufacturing, which are more reliable. I believe last time I saw, you'll know better than me, 70% of our economy now is people spending money. People are still spending money. That doesn't make sense because everyone tells me credit card debt's through the roof and everyone's poorer. What's happening?
Yeah, I mean, we're still not seeing the real evidence of that, right? The Black Friday shopping was through the roof, and that is not, that is where you would expect to see it lagging, right? Like, grocery retail sales aren't going to go down. People always need groceries. People aren't going to spend less on housing because they literally can't, as reasons we've discussed before. But if people are still getting into the reason of the season and you have the busiest holiday travel weekends, which we had, it means that clearly things aren't slowing down quite so much. And that's why, Jesse, really, it's not all about consumer spending. The whole reason why markets globally are obsessed with the concept of AI is because they understand our future labor force is smaller, it's dumber, it's fatter. The only input you can have if you don't want to just do open borders, which don't work anyway because you don't want to have a bunch of people who come in and use welfare, is AI, because it's all about productivity. So if, you know, if the Magnificent Seven, if they can revolutionize our worker productivity, that's great. If it doesn't work, the bubble burst we're in for will be hellacious.
You wrote about people buying now and paying later. If my father was alive today, I could just see his blood pressure going through the roof at the thought of that. But apparently this is a new thing. I've seen people do this on things like DoorDash.
Yeah, no, you know, I'm not Dave Ramsey. I'm not going to say don't use a credit card, because guess what? Credit cards are great because they help you build credit. And credit is how, unless your last name is Trump, credit's probably how you're going to have to buy a home, right? Most of us try and save up to do the 20% down payment. You get a good mortgage rate. You want to get better than they're offering now. And then you buy a home, right? This buy now, pay later, it's essentially commoditized payday loans, you know, loan sharking. And so this is, we will see more of this, Jesse, if Republicans follow, you know, this dangerous path where they want to ally with Dick Durbin and the Democrats in order to do credit card control caps. No, the whole point of a credit card as a line of credit of last resort is that it's fixed. The credit card company knows that not everyone will pay, everyone should pay off the balance at the end of every single month. But if you don't pay off the end of the balance in 1 month because, you know, your spouse is out of work for 1 month because they're out sick and you know it's a fixed amount of debt you have to take in order to, you know, pay childcare, whatever, you aren't cut off at the knees. The buy now, pay later thing, it really is a house of cards, and it's kind of this gambling economy that it's the people, it makes me feel rather old, because Gen Z seems to love sort of treating the economy a little bit like it's a slot machine. In some ways, quite literally, they spend a lot of money on sports gambling. They do day trading, which defies a lot of the rules of classic investment, which is put in a set amount of savings and don't touch it, and then look at it maybe when you're 65 or older and actually want to retire. But, you know, buy now, pay later is a part of it. It's people living for the now. And this is, you know, again, why housing needs to become a bigger part of the conversation is because it's part of the American dream for good reason. People know they have to save up to get that 20%. So it has to feel somewhat in reach. If it doesn't feel in reach and people have nothing to save for, why wouldn't you finance a pizza?
Oh, finance a pizza. I'm not going to go full Daddy Jesse at this point in time and lose my mind. It's just the thought of, please don't ever finance a pizza. That's all I'm going to say. Please don't finance a pizza, anybody. Your gut starts to matter more to you as you get older. When you're young, at least when I was young, I could eat anything. I could eat a pizza with extra jalapenos on it at 11 o'clock at night, right before bed. Sleep like a baby, wake up, feel fine. You remember what those days were like? Those days are gone, aren't they? It's gone. Now we have to be more conscious about our gut health. My sister's the one who told me about cowboy colostrum. she said, "Oh man, I'm like, my God's, it's been feeling so good. I feel like I'm 20 again." So I decided, okay, I'll try it. I pour a couple scoops of my coffee in the morning. I have the chocolate one. I essentially have a chocolate cup of coffee, no gut problems ever, no matter what. Stuff is friggin' miraculous. You want to try some Cowboy Colostrum? They have vanilla, chocolate, strawberries, delicious. Put it in some milk. Put it in a cup of coffee. Go to cowboycolostrum.com. Just use the code JesseTV. It's not that we can bring prices back to where they were. We talked about that in the opening of the show. We can't go back. Toothpaste isn't going back in the tube. But what we most definitely should be doing is ensuring they don't keep going up, 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 and spinning out of control. And what we have to do is we have to stop this idea that the federal government should claim more control over the various parts of the economy that are going crazy right now. That's the exact opposite of what we should be doing. Get these idiots out of the economy so maybe we can afford Red Lobster again. All right? All right. We'll do it again.
Why should you listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand?
We're not boring. A lot of news is boring.
And tedious.
And depressing.
And makes you angry. You don't want to live your life like that.
Hey, I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty.
We're Armstrong and Getty.
We try to bring you the truth.
And help you figure out this crazy modern world.
How about something about a comedic tone?
We have a winner.
Yes. Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on the iHeartRadio app,
Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.